The sound seminar you are about to hear was recorded by Viktor E. Frankl, Professor of Psychiatry and Neurology at the University of Vienna and head of the Department of Neurology at the Polyklinik Hospital in Vienna. He is presently the president of the Austrian Medical Society of Psychotherapy. Dr. Frankl is well known internationally as the originator of the school of psychotherapy known as logotherapy or existential analysis. His most recent publication is Psychotherapy and Existentialism, Selected Papers on Logotherapy. The subject of this sound seminar is What is Meant by Meaning? Here is Dr. Frankl.
It is my contention that self-transcendence is the essence of human existence. In plain words, being human always means to be directed to something other than oneself. In other words, man is characterized by his reaching out for meaning and purpose in life. And restless is his heart, to couch it in Augustinian terms, unless he has found and fulfilled meaning and purpose in life. This statement epitomizes much of the theory and therapy of neurosis, at least insofar as that type which I've termed noogenic is concerned. However, man's basic meaning orientation, his original and natural concern with meaning and values, is endangered and threatened by that pervasive reductionism which is prevalent in Western civilization. This reductionism is likely to undermine and erode idealism and enthusiasm, particularly in young people. Along the lines of reductionism, the human being is portrayed as nothing but, say, a computer. But humans are not objects, says William Irwin Thompson, that exist as chairs or tables. They live. And if they find that their lives are reduced to the mere existence of chairs and tables, they commit suicide, unquote. Reductionism itself may be reduced by being traced to relativism and subjectivism. Let us then ask ourselves whether or not meanings and values are as relative and subjective as some believe them to be. To anticipate our answer to this question, meanings and values are both relative and subjective. However, they are so in a different sense from that in which relativism and subjectivism conceive of them. In which sense, then, is meaning relative? Meaning is relative inasmuch as it is related to a specific person who is entangled in a specific situation. One could say that meaning differs in two respects. First, from man to man, and second, from day to day, indeed from hour to hour. It's true that if I read a speech, the situation unites me and my audience. But the meaning of the situation is still different. Our tasks are different. You have to listen. I have to talk. To be sure, I for one would prefer to speak of uniqueness rather than relativity. Uniqueness, however, holds not only for a situation, but also for life as a whole, since life, after all, is a chain of unique situations. Thus, man is unique in terms of both existence and essence. He is unique in that, in the final analysis, he cannot be replaced. And his life is unique in that no one can repeat it. There is therefore no such thing as a universal meaning of life, but only the unique meaning of individual situations. However, we must not forget that among these situations, there are also situations which have something in common, and consequently there are also meanings which are shared by human beings throughout society and even more throughout history. Rather than being related to unique situations, these meanings refer to the human condition. And these meanings are what is understood by values, so that one may define values as those meaning universals which crystallize in the typical situations a society or humanity has to face. By values or meaning universals, man's search for meaning is alleviated, inasmuch as at least in typical situations, he is spared making decisions. But alas, he has also to pay for this relief and benefit. For in contrast to the unique meanings pertaining to unique situations, it may well be that two values collide with one another. And as is well known, value collisions are mirrored in the human psyche in the form of value conflicts, and as such, play an important part in the formation of noogenic neurosis. Let us imagine that the unique meanings referring to unique situations are points, while values or meaning universals are circles. It is understandable that two values may overlap with one another, whereas this cannot happen to unique meanings. But we must ask ourselves whether two values can really collide with one another. In other words, whether their analogy with two-dimensional circles is appropriate. Would it not be more adequate to compare values with three-dimensional spheres? Two three-dimensional spheres projected out of the three-dimensional space down into the two-dimensional plane may well yield two-dimensional circles overlapping one another, although these spheres themselves do not even touch on one another. Likewise, the impression that two values collide with one another is due to the fact that a whole dimension is disregarded. And this dimension is the hierarchical order of values. According to Max Scheler, valuing implicitly means preferring one value to another. Thus, the rank of a value is experienced together with the value itself. The experience of one value includes the experience that it ranks higher than another. There is no place for value conflicts. However, this is not to say that the experience of the hierarchical order of values dispenses man from decision-making. Man is pushed by drives, but he is pulled by values. He is free to accept or reject a value he is offered by situation. It's up to him to take a stand as to whether or not he wishes to realize a value. This is true of the hierarchical order of values as it is transmitted and channeled by moral and ethical traditions and standards. They still have to stand a test. This sequence reflects the three principal ways in which man can find meaning in life. First, by what he gives to the world in terms of his creation. Second, by what he takes from the world in terms of encounters and experiences. And third, by the stand he takes when faced with a fate which he cannot change. This is why life never ceases to hold meaning, since even a person who is deprived of both creative and experiential values is still challenged by an opportunity for fulfillment, that is, by the meaning inherent in an upright way of suffering. By way of illustration, I would like to quote Rabbi Earl A. Goldman, who once received a call from a person dying of an incurable disease. "How can I meet the thought and reality of death?" she asked. And the rabbi continues to report, quote, "We spoke on numerous occasions, and as a rabbi, I introduced many of the concepts of immortality found in our faith. As an afterthought, I also mentioned the attitudinal value concept. Much of the theological discussion had made little impression upon her, but attitudinal values invited her curiosity, especially when she learned that the founder of this concept was a psychiatrist who was incarcerated in a concentration camp. This man and his teaching captured her imagination, for he knew more than just the theoretical application of suffering. She resolved then and there, if she could not avoid the inescapable suffering, she would determine the manner and mode in which she would meet the illness. She became a tower of strength to those around her whose hearts were lacerated with pain. At first it was a bravado, but with the passage of time, the act became invested with purpose. She confided to me, perhaps my singing act of immortality might be in the way I face this adversity. Even though my pain at times is unbearable, I have achieved an inner peace and contentment that I had never known before. She died in dignity and is remembered in our community for her indomitable courage." Unquote. I do not wish in this context to elaborate on the relationship between logotherapy and theology. Suffice it to say that in principle the attitudinal value concept is tenable and applicable irrespective of whether or not a religious philosophy of life is espoused. By now, we have dealt with the question in which sense meanings are relative. Now we have to proceed to the question of whether or not they are subjective. Is it not true that meanings are a matter of interpretation? And doesn't an interpretation always imply a decision? Are there not situations which allow for a variety of interpretations, among which one has to make a choice? Let me illustrate this by a story I once read in a Viennese newspaper. Some years ago, the owner of a tobacco shop was assaulted by a hoodlum. She cried out for Franz, her husband. The gangster thought that Franz was behind the curtain which divided the room and fled. Actually, however, this woman had not called for her husband. She could not even do so for the simple reason that he had died some weeks earlier. In her emergency and agony, his widow had sent a prayer to heaven and begged Franz to intervene with God for the sake of rescuing her at the last moment. Now, it is entirely up to each of us how to interpret this sequence of facts. One might see therein an understandable misunderstanding on the part of the hoodlum, or else assume that a prayer has been accepted by heaven. Why should not heaven hide a supernatural occurrence behind such a natural sequence of facts? Obviously, man is giving meanings to things which in themselves are neutral. And in the face of this neutrality, reality is like a screen upon which man projects his own wishful thinking, as is the case with Rorschach blots. Meanings then would be a mere means of self-expression, and therefore something intrinsically subjective. Actually, however, the only thing which is subjective is the perspective through which we approach the world. But this subjectivity of perspective does not in the least detract from the objectivity of the world itself. Human cognition is not of kaleidoscopic nature. If I look into a kaleidoscope, I do not see anything except that which is inside of the kaleidoscope itself. Contrarywise, if I look through a telescope, I see something which is outside of the telescope itself. And if I look at the world, I also see more than, say, the perspective. What is seen through the perspective, however subjective the perspective may be, is the objective world. In fact, seen through is the literal translation of the Latin word perspectum. The term objective can be substituted by another one, which is used by Rudolf Allers, namely transsubjective. This doesn't make a difference, nor does it make a difference whether we speak of things or meanings. Both are transsubjective. For meanings are found rather than given. If given at all, they are not given in arbitrary way, but rather in the way in which answers are given. That is to say that there is one answer only to each question, the right one. There is one solution only to each problem, the right one. And there is one meaning only to each situation, and this is its true meaning. Let me invoke what once happened on one of my lecture tours through the United States. Before a question period was started, my audience had been requested to print the questions in block letters. And after they had done so, a theologian passed the questions to me, but wished me to skip one, for, as he said, it was sheer nonsense. Someone wishes to know, he said, how you define 600 in your theory of existence. But I read the question in a different way. How do you define God in your theory of existence? Printed in block letters, God and 600 were hard to differentiate indeed. Well, was not this an unintentional projective test? After all, the theologian read 600 and the neurologist read God. Later on, I also used it intentionally by making the facsimile into a slide and showing it to my American students at the University of Vienna. And believe it or not, 9 students read 600. Another 9 students read God, and 4 students undecidedly vacillated between both modes of interpretation. Now, what I wish to demonstrate is the fact that only one way to read the question was the right one. Only one way to read the question was the way in which it had been asked. And only one way to read the question was the way in which it was meant by him who had asked it. Thus we have arrived at a definition of what meaning is. Meaning is what is meant, be it by a person who asks me a question or by a situation which too implies a question and calls for an answer. However it may be, I cannot say my answer right or wrong, as the British say, my country right or wrong. I must do my best and try hard to find out the true meaning of the question which I'm asked.